Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, attorney blogger on Bowtie Law, and with Jessica Meterson on The Legal Geeks. Today, we have a special podcast talking about She-Hulk, focusing on the practice of law and the new series. I have two guests with me, so this is one of those rare times we actually have live people. So this isn't just another webinar, Zoom type meeting, but it's an in-person discussion. So I would like each of my guests to introduce themselves.
Okay. Hi, I'm Marguerite Kenner. I'm Legal Valkyrie on Twitter. I'm also in training to be a solicitor in the UK, and I was an intellectual property paralegal here in the US for 10 years before I went overseas.
My name is Alistair Stewart. I'm on Twitter as Alistair Stewart, or possibly also Alistair Cookie. I'm a freelance journalist, RPG writer, and comics journalist, and I am Marguerite's fiancé.
Which is awesome, and I follow you both on Twitter, and we've interacted across the pond, and it was finding out that you'd both be in California in the Bay Area. It's like, let's get together, and I know you are a super She-Hulk fan.
Yes.
And I've read She-Hulk. I remember the John Byrne series and that came out in 1989, the Space Truckers and all kinds of fun stuff, and it was wicked cool. It was awesome. And then I stopped reading when I got to high school. So, let's talk about, first, Legal Valkyrie. What gave you the idea for that Twitter handle?
My old Twitter handle was Muse of Chaos. It was the first one when I got involved with Twitter many, many years ago. And when I started law school across the pond, I needed something that was going to be a little more representative of what it was I was going to be talking about. And brand identity is always an important thing when you're looking for training contracts and to continue work in the profession. And it combines my love of the law and geeks. Comic books and video games have always been my thing. My love of She-Hulk comes from the fact that she's a lawyer.
It's tough not to love that quality about her. And Alistair, but about yourself.
Well, I started writing when I was around 12. It was a short story about a golden dog. He had a ball. That was about the long and the short of it. But I really, really enjoyed the work. And I grew up on a tiny island in the middle of the Irish Sea called the Isle of Man, which meant everything to do with pop culture fascinated me because none of it was on the right side of the ocean for me. I went away to England to university. I ran a comic store for 7 years. I transitioned from that into small press comic work and comic journalism, and from that into podcasting and RPG design and freelance journalism now. And pop culture, and specifically the geek culture side of things, is something I profoundly love, and it's something I'm blessed in being able to do for a living.
That is extremely cool. I've yet to monetize the Legal Geeks in any way, shape, or form. So this is just a pure labor of love because I enjoy this stuff.
Yeah, we're both podcasters, actually. Alistair is the host of Pseudopod, which is an escape artist's horror fiction show, and I run Cast of Wonders, which is a young adult fiction podcast. It's actually how we met, just through Twitter and through podcasting.
It is a neat way to meet. Jessica and I met through Twitter over an e-discovery post.
Oh, nice.
And so that led to a couple tweets exchanged, a couple direct messages exchanged, couple quotes of Blazing Saddles and Caddyshack, and I thought, we could do great things. This could be an adventure.
Nice.
And thank you, Twitter. Thank you, blogging, and that Judge Fasciola opinion with the cowboy reference, because it was because of that.
Oh, nice.
That I did my spaghetti western e-discovery post, and that's Jessica retweeted it, and that's how we came to be the Legal Geeks.
Very cool.
It's groovy. So, the new She-Hulk series. We got the first four issues. What do you like about it?
I love that it's written by a lawyer. Charles Schulz knows his stuff. I got hooked when I read the first issue, and there's a panel where Jessica is holding a motion complaint, and it says, "Comes now, plaintiff," across the top. And I thought, all right, I'm hooked. He's got the language right. And I haven't been able to put it down since.
That jumped out to me as well, because I was reading, I was like, this feels right.
Exactly.
This feels right. They're using the right terms, and it's more a lawyer story than it is
a superhero story. Very much so.
Which is just cool. And the John Byrne series, there was a lot of the lawyer material in there. That was, I think, more on the superhero side. I haven't reread all the issues from 1989, but issues 10 and 11, which I read last night, it's like, okay, there's at least good references to the practice. And her leaving the courthouse and getting really annoyed by a reporter saying, like, hey, we're bored with your case. And She-Hulk picking him up by his throat and saying, the law's not entertainment, this is not how the process is supposed to work. It's like, all right, so like in 1989, or by then maybe 90, Byrne was like, took that approach and was actually helping defend the practice
right
through She-Hulk, which was like, yes.
Exactly.
So let's talk about what were some of the legal issues in issue one.
Let's see. Where does it start off? I'm trying to remember right now.
So they want her to be the rainmaker at the firm. That's why she's an associate.
Right. So she's billed 2,800 hours in the year, and she doesn't get a bonus. And the firm basically fires her. They say, you didn't bring us the clients we wanted. And she decides she's going to set up practice for herself, which she does. What's the analogy they use? It's called, there's some neat abbreviation for under a view.
Dumbo,
right. Under the bridge. So she sets up her own office, and the process she goes through just of having to locate a building, having to find staff, the whole nine yards.
That office space, because it's by someone who was a mutant that lost her powers mm-hmm. on M-Day, must have hellacious insurance.
I think she makes a reference to it, yeah.
Because, I mean, it just must be. And the disclosures that would have to be and the release of liability that would have to be signed to rent there because people might be blowing stuff up, that would have to be wacky.
Exactly. It's got to have the most disclaimers you've ever seen. In any insurance document.
Well, let's talk about when she gets her first client, which is kind of that I really enjoyed how you see the duty of the profession to someone seeking legal aid. And they did a very nice job of that, of she doesn't want this case.
Right.
But somebody comes to her and says, like, this is what I have. It's a patent infringement. I got kids. My husband was a supervillain, got killed. Can you help me?
I like the panels of you seeing her in the background because Jen, of course, has had a bad day. She's at the front of the bar having a drink. And you see the woman with the file talking to different groups behind her until she finally approaches Jennifer. I thought that was handled really well.
Yeah, and it's an interesting form of prospecting or attorney shopping where
exactly.
You have somebody that desperate for help. And so it's just well played because there's the duty of loyalty to the client and the duty of competency, but they handle that well, especially as they're going through the storage shed. And the kids are in the car crying. And it's not quite the Aaron Brockovich type of thing.
Exactly.
Or civil action, but going like, no,
I'm going through the stuff. Jen makes a neat comment in the middle of that issue. She talks about, she's very honest with the woman. She says, this is not what I expected this to be. I read your documents, and I thought I could fix this with a phone call. So that's what I did. I tried to fix it with a phone call. But she doesn't give up. When it becomes more difficult, you see her digging through the locker, getting her hands dirty, looking for the information she needs.
And that kind of discovery would stink. You go through.
Literally.
Doc review isn't fun. No one goes to law school going like, I can't wait.
To be trapped in a room with 80,000 boxes.
I just can't wait. And I did construction defect litigation the first part of my career. So I got to like put on coveralls and crawl under houses, which on one level was kind of fun because it's more exciting than being at the office. But the other level was, I'm in coveralls crawling through a house.
Yeah. You probably didn't find any old Doombots, though.
No, that was not, they were not there. Mold was. And that was not good. Because that was like our client's fault. But, that's why we settled. So it's patent litigation.
Yes.
And could you walk us through the process that she engages in against Stark?
Right. Well, she thinks she can just walk in and talk to him and solve the issue. But she gets routed to legal. And Legal is such an interesting character. I really hope we get to see more of him. His final line to Jen is, "I'm neither good nor bad, I'm merely Legal."
I love, now granted, it was a little hurtful he was in a bow tie. on one level, I want to like you. And I love the fact he traced all the corporate entities of Stark. It was just like, rock on with Stain and Jim Rhodes. It was just like, yes.
Everything, all in one panel. It's like, you can see exactly where everything interacts with all the corporate work that, you know, that's been being done.
And it was just like, rock on. You know, that was brilliant. I was, thank you, God, for that. And in tracing the corporate entities that Stark has had, and go like, well, which one?
Yeah.
Because that would be an issue of, like, who are you going to sue? Because you can't just go up and sue Tony Stark for something that happened with whatever LLC 10 years ago. You have to find the right one.
And whatever it is now, and whoever is still contiguous, and all of that. Exactly.
So that was interesting. But I thought she was right about getting FaceTime with Stark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she had not mentioned Legal at the receptionist desk,
it might have worked that early.
It might have been a happy ending. And her, you know, you don't find out the amount that Tony pays the widow.
No, you don't.
But you see the check for $150,000.
That the widow gives her out of gratitude, and you have no way of knowing how that relates at all to the settlement amount.
Yeah, which could be, I mean, if it's only like 10% or something, that actually could be a reasonable attorney's fee for making that happen. The fact that you didn't have extensive discovery and extensive litigation, because Stark's lawyers are like lining up like drones.
They sure tried. The tables full of boxes and binders was very, very familiar. They just tried to bury her in paperwork. That was very Aaron Brockovich style.
It was brilliant, because it's like, you know, this is kind of seeming familiar, and all the legal hoops that they were jumping through. Granted, they couldn't serve her with everything then and there. Mm-hmm. She would have needed to have been hit with that like the day before. And if they're going to what presumably would be a Rule 16B scheduling conference.
Right.
You know, it's, even though the rules are different in patent court, you know, we're not dealing with the Rader model order here or anything that crazy.
Patent is all federal. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's just conducted through individual districts.
Yeah, so there's... That is interesting, because, like, what's the discovery? And, you don't see her issuing a litigation hold.
Mm-hmm.
But that would have been interesting. What's Stark's, like, destruction policy for data? You know, how do we go after and go, like, so was this 10 years ago? I don't remember in the comic they say when it took place.
Mm-hmm.
5 or 10 years. But there might be emails and other communications. And if Tony's archiving system is more robust than what we're used to.
Well, you have to imagine it must be, because he has Jarvis.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you can make AIs that do stuff and flying robot drones, you would think that you have an impressive retention policy that I don't delete anything. I just keep it all.
Exactly.
Because I can. Because I might need it someday.
Right.
So that I really liked.
What I liked is that from Legal's perspective, one of the tactics they took with trying to make the case go away, because they are trying to make the case go away, they're overwhelming her with motions,
uh-huh.
and several of the motions he wants to bring are to remove Jen as the attorney on personal grounds, and it never goes anywhere. From a purely legal perspective, she gets evidence, and the case is settled based on evidence, not on the tactics that Legal, not even Tony, but Legal, is trying to portray.
Well, that, and she does what every lawyer's dreamed about, and going into an office and just starting and rolling heads.
Wouldn't that be efficient?
No, I'm going to go talk to him. You know, you start smashing the robots, and you get FaceTime with the dude, and go like, dude, we're friends. We've slept together. You know, you should take my phone calls.
Not now, Tony. I'm not in the mood.
Yeah, so, and Tony, being Tony, does switch to charm mode.
Exactly.
Because that's that's what Tony Stark does. Now, I had an issue with the evidence. That probably would have resulted in a ton of motion practice, because this discussion that was recorded in secret took place in California. It's illegal to record people without their consent in California. And so the statute at play is California Penal Code Section 632. And I looked at a few cases and not quite sure how it would go, because in some situations, like where it was a doctor who was secretly recorded by a news crew trying to pin him on giving prescription drugs that should not have been given, the news crew was able to run the story and that was fine, but the doctor could still sue him for damages for breaking the law.
Under libel? Or?
Well, no, because they broke that statute, but it was a newsworthy thing that they did. So there wasn't like a right to not run the story.
Mm.
But because the conversation was secretly recorded, the doctor could sue on those grounds.
So even though the evidence couldn't have been used from the perspective of if the news crew had brought a case, let's say, against the doctor could still rely on the evidence on the grounds that it was recorded without his consent.
Maybe. You know, I think this is where I'm not sure on how it would go, because I started reading the cases and started to realize we have a good statute, but the interpretation's a little weird. Because I get the impression that it would come into, it's not like it's excluded from evidence. It's not like it's in violation of Miranda or something like that.
Okay.
That's an unlawful confession or recorded confession type of thing. Because those are entirely different. This is civil.
Right.
And so the remedy might be that Stark's attorneys could not suppress the evidence, but they could argue and counterclaim against that you violated the law by secretly recording one of our executives.
And then it becomes a question of if that organization is still in play in any way.
Exactly. And in looking at the fee being like only, you know, $2,500, that's just a drop in the bucket to Stark or to, you know, that they could take out of the settlement if they really wanted to pursue that. But then they're just looking petty.
But didn't it take place 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, but this statute's been around a while.
But I'm thinking from the perspective of, could they argue that there should be interest from the date of the violation?
I don't know. I don't know if they would go down that road.
I'm just thinking about how other ways they could maybe consider the number inflated enough to be worth the pursuit.
Then this is also, you can deal with a weird crime fraud exception as well,
right?
Because what they were doing wasn't legal to begin with. So there's a little of that. So it's in California, you're not supposed to record people without their consent.
Right.
The plaintiff did that. The defendant's corporate agent is not in the picture anymore. I don't know if he's dead or just not there, but he's no longer an employee. So that might just be something that they have to eat and going like, we're going to knock out $3,000 from the settlement. That's probably in the billions. Ooh.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's not worth the effort. It probably costs more to build the time to think about doing it than it is to actually do it.
And they would look petty.
Exactly. It looks like sour grapes.
So Alistair, your impressions of issue one.
The two things which I really took away from it that fascinated me were really connected to how Jen was portrayed as a female comic character. I mean, one of the very few downsides to doing what I do is it is profoundly depressing at times watching how female characters are treated in the vast majority of comics, and superhero comics in particular. You know, I described it in a review a little while ago as they all seem to be graduates of the no pelvis school of body image. And the two things which I really loved were, firstly, she's allowed to be clever. The entirety of the issue, as the pair of you have been talking about, it's almost a race back through the causality of what's gone on, and not even to the point where you find who's at fault, but who's least at fault. And cutting across that is Jen's personal connection to Tony and the point that you finally get to with the, look, here's what you're going to do because you're not an asshole. And the other thing which I really dug about it was I naturally gravitate towards a type of character that I tend to refer to as the guy next to the guy. My favorite BSG character is Hela. for example, because fundamentally, you know, Hilo, bless his cotton socks, spends four seasons going, I'm not cool with this. And he's very quietly the kind of moral center of a lot of the show. He also does a couple of fantastically awful things because no one gets away with it on BSG all the time. But the thing which I really responded to with how Shul has written Jen, in particular in issue one, is she's grounded and she's pragmatic and she's sensible and she's fundamentally decent. She's it's such a banal phrase, it almost sounds loaded. She's a good person. And the sequence that Marguerite mentioned with, you know, watching the lady go around the lawyer bar, and the very subtle body language you get in that, where she goes in the space of a page from, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this, to, what can I do for you? And that, more than anything else, is the definition of a hero for me. It's the person who does the thing they don't want to do that's right. And I love that Jen, along with Kamala Khan in Ms. Marvel, Carol Danvers in Captain Marvel, is one of this kind of triumvirate of Marvel female characters who are definitively female and cool and kick-ass and the three best people in their respective universes without being dull. That's the other thing. She's cool, but she's also decent, nice.
Without crossing the line into matriarchal or precisely, motherly, which is such an easy stereotype for female characters to fall out back on.
She's not baking cookies, even though I have nothing against cookies.
Oh, right there with you.
You know, and if somebody bakes me cookies, I'm profoundly loyal at that point. Fight to the death.
But Jen's a professional. She's a professional woman who's also a hero.
She doesn't come across as bimbo, which is important to me, because that's one of those things that has always bothered me about portrayal of some women. The other quality is it speaks to the heart of being an attorney, which I greatly appreciate. That somebody comes to you seeking legal representation, you have an ethical obligation to be there.
And just that's why so many of us approach the profession. We're here to help.
Mm-hmm. And that was the nice part of the story for me, is she's staying true to her oath as an attorney, which I think was great.
There's an image that closes out issue one, and I love it. Obviously, they love it because they reuse it a couple of issues later. And it's after she fights her way up through the building to talk to Tony and does the here's what you're going to do speech. And she's striding off. Her workout gear is kind of shattered. She's missing a shoe. Her hair's mussed up. She's obviously been in a fight. And Tony just is looking at her in the background going, you're magnificent. And her response line is, still not in the mood, Tony, but you are not wrong. And there is so much thematic narrative intelligence wrapped up in that one line. Because you have the traditional iconic thing of, if you're a Hulk, your tailor is going to be a very rich person. You know, her clothes are messed up, but at the same time, her head's held high, her posture is good, she's happy because she's helped her client, she's helped her friend, because that's the genius thing about the end of issue one, that fundamentally it's her sitting down with Tony going, you're not a tool, you are acting like a tool. I will ensure that not only do you not look like a tool, but you will help this nice lady who, through no fault of her own, you've been actively quite unpleasant.
Everybody wins with this solution.
Exactly. And it's this kind of beautiful, unique, fundamentally legal moment of heroism. And that image is almost a mission statement for the book. And I love that, I think it's the start of issue three, and they reuse the image with a big long speech from her talking about what's happened so far.
It's the recap image.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is heralding back to John Byrne.
The John Byrne era, where she's talking to you.
Yeah, because they broke the fourth wall all the time.
Yeah.
And so this one is beginning with that as the recap, which is like a nice hat tip.
Exactly. Yeah.
To the sensational She-Hulk book from 89-90 time period.
Right.
And I love the kind of punchline which really drives that home of, by the way, kids, Marvel sold way too much advertising this month, so no letters column. Sorry about that.
You know, yes.
Now on with the show. You know, I love that.
It's that, you know, Stan Lee golden age snark that we all love so much.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just fun. Well, that's issue one. Let's talk about issue two, which is more a fundamental kind of getting the law practice going type of issue.
So this is where we get the tour of the building and learn about its potentially ruinous insurance premiums. I think this may also be the issue where we find out that Jen's on a clock, that she only has about 8 months worth of expenses up and ready to go, and she faces the classic legal problem of building a practice. She's had a case, and she knows what she wants to do. Now she's got to go out and find the work.
Which is a challenge for her because her prior firm is blackballed her.
Exactly. So she's reaching out to all of her contacts and finding out she's being stonewalled.
Yeah, and that was cool. But you also think about, again, putting on the lawyer hat and having like opened an office once. You know, you have to put up all the OSHA signs and all the employment signs.
Exactly.
We have the interview process with the lady with the monkey to become the personal assistant. And then Hellcat goes on the strangest job interview ever.
Fueled by martinis.
Yeah, so, you know, they're drinking Cosmos and Hellcat's drinking a green one. So I'm not sure what, maybe an Appletini, I'm not sure. But, you know, they're out drinking and dancing and then decide to go out and fight crime after drinking extensively. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly.
I mean, I love the AIM guys watching them. And, and one of them's like, I think she's drunk. You know, and it's like, we could take her. It's like, you don't have kids. You know, like that line, you know.
They remind me of 21 and 24 from the Venture Brothers.
Yeah, it's just, it's awesome having the AIM guys going, oh, this isn't a good idea, man. No, we can do it. No, man, this isn't a good idea.
I just want to know from a logistical point of view, did they have their costumes and their handbags? How did they change?
Yeah, I don't know, but the fact that Hellcat looks blurred, I don't know if that means she's stumbling and tripping over herself throughout it or what. I do wish, again, this might sound strange coming from, you know, the heterosexual male, but I would like She-Hulk to wear more clothing.
Yeah. That,
you know, if you're going out to fight crime, you think you would want more body protection. I recognize she's a Hulk. She's bulletproof and, you know, you can throw her off a building. But, you know, basically wearing the swimsuit, you know, and high boots, I would wear more clothes.
The only thing I can think of is that maybe the outfit is convenient to wear underneath the suits, and that's
possible.
Why it's possible. The Marta Acosta novel, Single Green Female, spends, which is fantastic, and it kind of covers the period of time between when these comic books start and the end of the previous run, where she's still in corporate practice and how she adjusts. And one of the first things she does is she gets a decent wardrobe, and she has it tailored so that Jennifer can remove it safely before She-Hulk fully transforms. So we could probably do an entire podcast on the female hero issue with wardrobe, but
There is an interesting side issue to that. It's something which, certainly from the kind of the Dan Slott era in particular, and Byrne, did this a lot of the time. There's an aesthetic choice that gets made with Jen an awful lot, which is really sensible. And it's something which drives me crazy with other female characters. Because, I mean, I am engaged to a martial artist. Lots of my friends are female martial artists. And I train myself. And one of the fundamental things that you learn is if you're doing a striking form, or even if you're doing a grappling form, you need a stable platform. There is no high-heeled shoe on earth that is going to give you a stable platform to defend or attack from. And in particular, the point where, years ago where I stood up and applauded was when Darlene Cook finally got Catwoman out of the ridiculous purple body stocking and dominatrix boots and into a pair of motorbike boots.
And she got a chunky heel at that point.
Yeah, and that aesthetic has carried through to Jen, which again speaks to the character's practicality and pragmatism. She's a woman who, in her other day job, is going to be getting into a lot of fights. You're either going to need a decent center of gravity or to be able to run like hell. Can't do that in high heels. And I love that her wardrobe, at least in that respect, echoes her character.
Yeah.
I mean, those are obviously boots with a good heel.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, the combat boots things are good, but I still prefer the Lady Sif type body
absolutely.
Or the new Carol Danvers look, the bodysuit. I mean, you see that in the Miss Marvel comic. Kamala has a huge issue with how much skin is exposed in her costume, and I really hope that the trend more towards the Carol Danvers approach continues.
That would be nice. I mean, I understand with the Hulk, part of it is you want to see the ripped up clothing, but there's only so many times that we can have Jen going into court, like wearing a ripped up blouse and a bra, that a judge is going to go, okay.
Precisely.
Yes.
You might be able to get away with it once or twice. You know, it's like, hey, sorry, I just had to stop this massive like training accident. You know, they'll give a free pass because you have a green lawyer in front of you occasionally, but not like every time.
You'd think in a universe with the Avengers that they would have a closet in the courthouse where people could change.
If nothing else, it would behoove, I mean, sure, at present, certainly, it would behoove, you know, Jen's current scriptwriter to hang a lantern on it, that you have her come in and, you know, the shattered business suit and just have the judge go, really, Miss Walters? Hmm. Again?
There was a disturbance.
Yes.
Sorry, I was fighting the giant robot.
Doesn't that happen in the previous run? Don't they pull her parking pass because she abuses it too many times to park at the red curb in front of the court to rock up late?
I think you're right.
I think they do.
The slot run.
I did not read that, so that would be good to know.
Yeah, that's her in corporate practice abusing her position as an Avenger before she's kicked out. And then the Acosta novel covers what happens to her professional life having left the Avengers.
In fact, the Acosta novel has quick change closets.
Okay.
Because Marta has an awful lot of fun with almost the kind of more practical elements that you would need for the Marvel Universe to run. Jen has access to the network of tunnels under New York. And I think there's a reference to she actually has one that comes up in the central courtroom. In one of the side closets and has a couple of quick changes of clothing in there.
Yeah, when she hires on to the new firm, she intentionally negotiates a meditation room where she stores spare clothing exactly for this purpose.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. Because if you're going to Hulk out and rip up the outfit for the day, be it the pantsuit or the skirt, you know, it's going to get tatters, you're going to need a change of clothes.
A judge is finally going to put their foot down and say, you go change and then you may appear. And if that means you're after 4 o'clock, then that's your fault, not mine.
There are real rules when it comes to courtroom attire.
Exactly.
You're not supposed to wear shorts to court. You don't wear a hat to court. You know, I'm not going to wear an ascot to court. You're supposed to.
Unless you're the Son of Doom, maybe.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next. So let's talk about Christoph.
Oh.
So at the end of, he's introduced at the end of issue 2.
Correct.
As the next client. And then we see it's the race to the courthouse. And I had, well, why don't you give us the premise of what issue 3 is about?
Issue 3 is Christoph, the Son of Doom, is applying for, it's amnesty. He wants to get protection from the government against his father, Doom, and he's decided, having been rejected by 15 other firms, that Jen is going to be his attorney.
The entire client interview is pretty cool. You know, I thought that was awesome with, did you just hit on me? Maybe. You know,
it happens.
Because you know, that's just how he's been raised. He's like, you know, royalty and in a dictatorship. So used to snapping his fingers and having people cater to his whims.
I think he says something along the lines of, right, off you go.
It's like, whoa, cowboy.
And Jen's response is, I need coffee.
Because they were out drinking the night before.
Exactly.
So I actually pulled the application for asylum, which is form I-589.
Which is accurately referenced in the comic.
And hat tip to them because they do the right stuff. And they're right about the 1 year period.
Correct.
So they actually did some legal research before doing this. Now, it's, you know, I'm a civil litigator, e-discovery guy, so like this is outside my purview.
Yeah.
So I did a little research on this, reading the instructions, because that's what lawyers do. We start with the instructions, then I looked at the form, because it's how I roll. Crazy. But when you do these applications, the federal districts actually require you to send them to specific places. And so for the folks in New York, I believe that it has to be sent to Vermont or Pennsylvania. I don't remember which.
But is that just the application or is that the hearing as well?
That's the application. Mm-hmm. And so California, like in the West Coast, it's like, okay, does it go to San Francisco or does it go to LA? Mm-hmm. And so like different, you know, so like they all have places where these applications are supposed to go. So Jen magically gets onto the courtroom calendar.
Without having completed an application.
And for giggles, you know, and I will show you the cell phone. I downloaded the form and then based on my comic book knowledge, decided to fill out the application for Christoph. And the stopwatch, I had it at, I cleared it, but it was right about 14 minutes.
And so that was not as burdensome as you would think.
No, and it was very straightforward. Now, granted, that was with getting to sections about such as, you know, the reasons, you know, that you couldn't go back. I was only doing like one sentence explanations.
And you would imagine that would be the meat of the application.
So you're looking at maybe 20 to 30 minutes to do this right, to actually have a couple strong sentences in each one, being able to go, because if the clock's ticking, you have to get it in the mail today.
Exactly.
Or if it's a way for it to be like uploaded to Pacer instead, which would be nice if we could do it that way to reduce the paperwork.
Exactly.
And make it more efficient so it doesn't have to cross three states to get someplace. That would be cool. But again, a couple sentences of, my father has brainwashed me into killing people in the past, and he wants to extend his life through mine.
Exactly.
So doing the application and looking at the rules, I don't think the judge would give Christoph asylum.
Even with the attorney for the government not having any objection whatsoever to Christoph's application, like happens in the comic.
Yeah, so let's hear the five things that disqualify him. Assisted in Nazi persecution or engaged in genocide. That doesn't mean be a Nazi, but you engaged in genocide. Mm-hmm. You've persecuted another person. Have been convicted by a final judgment of a particular serious crime and therefore represent a danger to the community of the United States. Are considered for serious reasons to have committed a serious non-political crime outside the United States. And five, represent a danger to the United States. Problem.
Yeah.
With that, because he's acted in Doom's place. Now, granted, you can argue he was brainwashed, but that's going to be a huge hearing and saying I was not mentally culpable.
Right.
And therefore, I should be allowed asylum because it wasn't me. And in fact, this is evidence of me. And the entire spy satellite thing, dropping the symbiotic virus onto everyone and going to war with Latvia, yeah, you can't blame me for that, even though I did it.
Christoph's making an extraordinary claim, and he needs extraordinary evidence, and he doesn't present any of that at the hearing.
No. But this might be enough to at least get the hearing and then get the interview.
Exactly.
But, I mean, Jen would have her work cut out in order to pull this off. It's probably possible, but you would have a really hard insanity defense to argue multiple times.
One thing that did strike me about that was, would he have a stronger case if he had come to, say, the intelligence services? If instead of trying to come in through their kind of immigration and naturalization process, and obviously we wouldn't get the issue of the comic if this had happened. It's a great issue, so I'm glad we did. But if Christoph had walked into the CIA head office and gone, my name is Christoph von Doom, I'm the teenage son of Dr. Doom, I would like to defect, I will tell you everything. Yeah.
That would work better.
Yes.
That would be smart. And Jen probably could have thought of that. Going, wait.
I got an
wait.
Idea.
I'm going to call my buddy at the CIA. Where's that SHIELD phone number? You know, and that probably would be a smarter play in making this work. So,
but that's what's smart about the comic. It's the adventures of a lawyer who happens to be a superhero. Mm. So we see it from the point of view that anyone else in the asylum process might, theoretically, minus the Doom bots, have seen it.
Yeah, and taking the fantastic car.
Oh, that was great. I love how she can fly in the thing.
Yeah, it's rock on. Now, he does have to prove that his life has been threatened on the basis of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. And he probably could actually argue like 4 out of 5.
Exactly.
I was going to say, he has a strong case for, you know, F, all of the above.
Yeah, because, yeah.
He wants to use me as his patsy and then, you know, engraft his mind upon me.
I'm a genetically engineered vessel who's been groomed for as a replacement. Exactly.
I think he has a lot to argue there. And my political opinion is, I don't want to do that.
Exactly.
I really don't want to do that.
Which is the argument we see him put forward to the judge in the hearing, mm-hmm. is that he wants the ability to basically have free will, and he can't do so within his country. And Jen very smartly points out that he's giving up a position of privilege in order to take this position, which strengthens his argument.
Which is a good argument. Mm-hmm. And I do love the judge with, you know, like not flinching with, so your like outfit's ripped up and you're, you know, in a bra and tattered blouse in my courtroom.
And the evil doom of the universe's son is standing there going up against his father. I would have run for the hills.
You know, they proceed. You know, because I'm just outside the regular practice and being able to work with e-discovery folks, you know, like I know judges. And I know enough of them that they probably do something like that. Well, carry on.
You've made my day interesting.
This is fascinating. Keep going.
I think at the point where something came crash, when Doom himself comes crashing through the courtroom roof, that's when it would have ceased to be interesting.
And in an act of war.
Exactly.
In an act of war again. So, because when you attack a federal building, mm-hmm. and you're the actual ruler of another country, that diplomatic immunity isn't going to fly anymore, because you've now crossed into an act of war.
Exactly.
Even though he didn't kill anyone, so that could be the argument, but you can't, like, attack federal property, threaten the lives of a government attorney, a federal judge, everyone else in the building who's a federal employee.
I'd love to see Marvel do a guide at some point, maybe with a lot of legal consultation, of what allowances they've taken with those sorts of legal positions in order to make the comic book universe function. Or are there just literally thousands and thousands of suits that happen off camera that we never see and that never have any impact on the universe that allows it to function the way we in the field would see it as?
Well, I think that's part of the underlying story of the Blue File and where they're going with this, why it's been, you know, this pro se plaintiff,
mm-hmm.
who's tried removing this case to North Dakota.
Right.
Okay, so, well, that's weird. And it's like she doesn't know the claims in it as well, which is also kind of weird to have a complaint and a change of venue without claims specifically stated. And I don't know if they just haven't turned the page yet, so we haven't seen it, but that's just weird because she acts like, I don't know what this case is about, but I'm a named defendant.
And when they first present the idea of the Blue File, it's in the very first issue, and you get the impression later on when she's reading it and then closes it quickly when she gets another case, that it's Jen putting off something she doesn't want to deal with, which we know is a character trait that she has. But when she comes back to the Blue File and you see that it's an action against multiple defendants, of all people who had been sued that would remember and take action, it would be a lawyer. So the fact that she doesn't remember being served, and yet the case seems to be proceeding, I mean, the paralegal makes a comment about, you must have been served, we're at this phase in the litigation and they're ready to move, it makes you think that they're bringing in superhero elements. It has memory been altered, or what's going to be the underpinning for why it is Jen wouldn't have taken this case the way she normally would have.
The thing which it put me in mind of is nothing more than the perception filter concept from Doctor Who, for that exact reason, that it's something which everybody's eyes just seem to slide off, including hers. Because that reference in the first issue, you will of course surrender all your clients to us, aside from the Blue File.
Which we took as a favor to you.
And it's that, as you say, it's the this very odd blind spot that every lawyer that knows about it has, where they go, that is a thing I am not going to touch, but pass on as fast as possible.
You know, like everybody in the DC universe just deals with the fact that Clark claimed to Superman in glasses. Nobody wants to talk about it. It ruins the illusion.
Or along similar lines, the glorious thing which Marvel did about 10 years ago. They had yet another story where Wolverine goes undercover in Madripoor by putting an eye patch on. I've seen where he goes into a bar, orders a drink, and the bartender does the kind of stand from South Park nose pinch and goes, I need to tell you something. Everyone knows who you are. Every time you've done this, everyone knows who you are. The only reason we call you Patch is you're Wolverine. And if we go, that's Wolverine, you'll kill us. Here's your drink. Don't hurt me.
But I'm really looking forward to issue 5 and seeing what they're actually going to do with all the buildup behind this blue file.
You know, and it was funny, reading comics that were 20 years old the other night, one of the villains that she fought was a guy who had a failed congressional run who went by Pseudonym Man. and which was basically a perception filter that that a marketing guy came up with, that you can see things, that's augmented reality type. Mm. And I was thinking, like, okay, this was 1990. This is very cool. Because, again, it's John Byrne, and he's a genius in thinking this stuff. But this failed congressional candidate wears this helmet, and basically what he thinks he can do, he can do.
Mm.
And so... Okay, do we have something like that taking place? You know, are they digging that deep? Or is this just lucky happenstance of me going like, oh, wow, let's read issue 11 again?
Exactly.
The other thing I can think of it being is I do think it's going to be superhero kind of mental power related. And that's because when the paralegal shows up, I can't remember what her name is, the woman with the monkey.
Who has like a psychic push.
Several times, exactly. In the background, we see her, I mean, these are not the droids you're looking for, with like, she does it to the federal bailiff, I think, in the courthouse.
Uh-huh.
And she's always asking very pointed questions about the blue file. It's the first thing she asks Jen for after she's hired. She said, should I review that? She wants that file. And she's, I seem to think that her presence, and it's quite mysterious, I mean, she has a monkey and it's never talked about, has to be related somehow with what's been set up. Is she a spy? Is she a power who's there trying to help Jen deal with the events of the file? I can't help but think that the two are related, and we're going to find out more about it.
The other possibility, which speaks very strongly to that, is almost the kind of Grant Morrison-esque concept, that the blue file is sentient, that it's an idea that is trying to create itself, it's trying to write itself into existence.
Like a meme.
Like a meme. And the people who are named as defendants are the people who will allow it to take physical form.
So what's the list of the people who are in the blue file? Because I don't recognize many of the names, though I think in the dialogue around the issue, they say, isn't that so-and-so?
They do list it. I don't remember in what one. So is it in...
I think it's at the end of 4 when she starts to read it.
Yeah, so issue 5 is blue. Okay. It looks like Dr. Druid. There was another reference to it where we actually see it and it's clearer. Might be 2. It's not this one.
Yeah, I think you were in the right place.
So I was going through this the other day preparing for this.
Wyatt Wingfoot, Greer Grant Nelson, that's Tigra?
Yep.
Yeah.
Herman Schultz, a shocker. And then we have...
So this is issue 2 on page 3.
There's a copy of the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So, or the motion with the photograph, we have to assume, of the people who've been named in this action.
Yeah.
Also, the two people at the bottom here, the lady on the right is Monica Rambeau, who was Captain Marvel, and then changed to Photon. And that flat top looks an awful lot like Blade.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Yes.
Can you identify these other 5?
That's Shocker. That's Tigra.
Mm-hmm.
That's Wyatt Wingfoot, who is a Captain America supporting character, if I remember correctly. I do not know who Zoidberg in Shades there is.
Yeah, no. Dr. Druid, who's dead the last I knew. But
yeah.
Can we think of anything that they have in common?
You have superheroes and supervillains there. The interesting thing is you have at least 4 Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Tigra, Wyatt, Jen, and Captain Marvel have all been Avengers. And most recently, Blade has been revealed to be a character who, in the first few issues of the title, was wearing a knockoff Spider-Man outfit called Spider Hero, which was in fantastically awful disco green and pink in Mighty Avengers. He's revealed to be Blade.
Okay. So that's okay. Because I saw that, I was like, I can't look at you. Okay, but the plaintiff's name is George Sawitz.
Mm-hmm.
which is interesting. We'll see how that plays into things as well. And so, like, this doesn't go back to the assault on the Avengers mansion, because Druid wasn't there for that, even though some of the other Avengers were. It's, and granted, I also have that 20-year gap, you know, with college and law school where I wasn't reading, so
yeah.
I was reading other things, not comics. There was a lot of reading.
I finished my last exam last week. I understand what you mean.
Can't make the voices stop. But so it's interesting. I like to see where they're going with this, and I appreciate the fact that a lawyer's writing it, which brings us to the cameo or short appearance with the other lawyer in the Marvel universe. Because if there's a third, I don't know who it is.
Nope. Nelson and Murdoch.
So Matt Murdock, who's been disbarred in New York and is now in San Francisco, practicing law in San Francisco.
So let's talk about that real quick.
Okay, so he perjured himself in a case, and that got him disbarred in New York State.
Right.
That might get him disbarred in California.
At the very least, it should trigger an ethical review of his status in California. And he doesn't make any reference to whether or not that's happened and he's been cleared, or if it's coming, or if it's going to happen.
And I didn't get a chance to check this because my memory's faded on it, but President Clinton, after perjuring himself, either gave up his bar license or lost it. Because I remember a lot of folks talking about he perjured himself, and we don't like it when lawyers do that.
Correct.
Thinking back, this is the other extreme case where a president actually was licensed in two states, and that was Nixon. After Watergate, we had Nixon is the reason why we have ethical rules for attorneys, because most of the lawyers involved in Watergate were California attorneys, which is why California developed the first set of ethical rules for lawyers, because they were a little wigged out by the number of California attorneys who did bad things.
Right.
So, he either resigns from New York or they just bar him.
He says he was disbarred, so okay. I have to imagine it was...
This is President Nixon.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. California, Nixon does try resigning from the California bar so they don't disbar him. And the California bar rejected President Nixon's resignation so they could disbar him.
Wow.
So, which is fairly unprecedented. So with that as a backdrop and precedent, when you think about you're disbarred in one state, there's going to be an ethical review of something.
And especially since he's such a high-profile person.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and I didn't have time to do legal research on ethical disbarment issues and whether or not getting disbarred for perjury in one state, because that means you perjured yourself in court.
Exactly. You've lied.
And lawyers really should not be doing that. And I think there would be an issue in California. He might lose his entire ability to practice because this isn't, it's tough to just draw the line of like, well, that happened in New York, Your Honor.
Here, I'm totally professional. Yeah.
That doesn't tend to fly well.
No, I can't imagine it would.
So, again, minor issue with him, and I'll need to do a little bit more research. I'm not reading Daredevil now, so the entire disbarment I didn't know about.
I read the first two, I believe it was, and I have to admit, I tried to go into it with an open mind, but I became extremely frustrated by the fact that all of the geography of San Francisco is wrong. And I know it's a small issue and it's something only kind of a native would pick up on, but it frustrated me so much. And there was absolutely no reference to his profession. I just stopped reading it.
That is obnoxious because the artist and the author should do a little research.
Right.
If you're going to, this story takes place in Philadelphia. Have you ever been there?
No.
Well, when you have an emergency on Treasure Island, and you want the police to respond, but you send everybody west of the street in question? I'm sorry, I'm done.
Well, it's like with Godzilla. You know, one of the there are many problems with Godzilla, but they send the children to Oakland via the Golden Gate Bridge.
Exactly.
It's like you
Really? So they took Highway 37 across?
Or so they went through Novato and over to...
Then took the Richmond-Santa Fe Bridge and then down. Or went like all the way up to Napa.
Exactly.
And then down. That's the long way to go.
Right.
It's tough to imagine a reason to do that unless traffic is so hellacious trying to cross the Bay Bridge.
And we've all been in it. But still, that's a 60-mile detour, maybe?
Yeah, and at that point, it's you'll be safe in Petaluma.
Why would you come back across? Just keep going to Shasta and stay there.
He's big. It'll take him a while to get there, but he can make it. So exactly. Let's just, where the River Cats play in Sacramento, put him there.
Pick a direction and just keep driving. Don't come back.
When you have to refuel, you've gone far enough. let's be smart about this. But yeah, that's a big thing. I mean, him on the Golden Gate Bridge and her chatting, that was interesting.
I found that was a great scene. I like the fact that you see Jen bundled up. Mm-hmm. So she's obviously, they paid attention to, it's got to be a heck of a breeze up there. He's doing handstands, of course, but that's what Daredevil does. Mm-hmm. And they have a lovely little commiserate moment about how he misses certain venues from New York.
Yeah, and it's how lawyers get together.
Exactly. Not necessarily on the top of the Golden Gate Bridge, but...
Never done that. Unlikely that will ever happen.
I'd love to go up there. The view must be amazing.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure the breeze is also quite impressive. and I think back to A View to a Kill, and it doesn't work for me.
No.
But
okay.
That being said, when lawyers get together and just start talking, whether it's about the practice and clients and... Now, this isn't zealous advocacy, which is, the name of the way that they painted the story.
Mm-hmm.
This is more duty of loyalty.
Yeah.
And going to illegally entering a hostile country for her client. I mean, it's more on the superhero side, but she's doing it for legal reasons to argue for her client.
You can draw some really interesting parallels to just lawyers who have other hobbies or talents as well. Jen knows that what she's contemplating doing comes from a part of her life that is not as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And she does what a smart person would do, which is get legal advice. Just because we're lawyers doesn't mean we know everything about the law. We need them too. I think we do a better job of knowing we need them sooner. And so she's quite smart when she wakes up and just goes, you know what? I need to talk to somebody. I'm going to go talk to someone who can help me. And Daredevil is unique. These two characters are the only ones that we know of in the Marvel Universe who come at their problems from the same perspective, that they have the legal perspective and they have the superpower perspective. And they're the only two people who can really speak to each other about this unique struggle.
And I think they're the only two comic book lawyer characters at all.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, DC doesn't have any.
Not to my knowledge.
To the best of my knowledge, they don't.
And not a mainline character. There could be one buried way, way down.
Somewhere
there.
Deep, yeah.
But I've never found one. But they could exist, but I don't think they do. And these are the only two big ones from Marvel.
Right.
The other interesting thing about that, and again, I wouldn't presume for this to be definitive, but I'm fairly certain this is the first time they've talked shop ever. I can't remember a Daredevil She-Hulk solo story prior to this. And
we do have isn't Luke Cage's girlfriend an attorney, or is it just that they both dated Luke and that's why they were talking?
They both have dated Luke because Jen has a cameo at the end of the first Mighty Avengers story arc, which then becomes a regular appearance. And there is a very nicely handled moment where Luke Cage's his partner is giving him grief about the fact that they need a lawyer. And of course, he's called Jen, who he used to date. And there's this wonderful line about, really? Well, you're sleeping on the power couch tonight. And she turns up, and of course the pair of them instantly click and go off to talk about him.
Not him.
Not
to
him.
Talk about not him.
to talk about definitely not him and leave him behind. But, to the best of my knowledge, I agree with you. I think they are the only two, and not just in Marvel. I think they are the only two, certainly in the kind of mainstream superhero comics.
Mm. Which is great. I mean, I like both of them for that reason.
Exactly.
again, we all like things that can that we can relate to. And being a lawyer, I kind of like seeing, you know, you have all these characters fighting for truth, justice, the American way.
But what about the paperwork? What about those of us who fight with the paperwork?
You know, none of that would exist without lawyers. You know, it's just how we, it is. It's you would need the legal system for that to happen. And I am excited for the Daredevil Netflix series, which I hope is awesome.
Yes.
There was somebody who tweeted us a while back who said that, you know, Jessica and I should have a cameo on it, which I was like, yes. I would be totally down with that. But
every single episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., every single Marvel movie, I am desperately, desperately looking and waiting for just a little reference. Just something like in Winter Soldier, when you saw the helicarrier starting to do the scanning, I was desperately looking at all the names going, please, where's Jed? Where's Jed? No.
Well, the fact Stephen Strange had that big shout out.
Oh, yeah.
Big shout out, which is appropriate because of Strange Tales, because those stories were Nick Fury and Doctor Strange.
Of course.
Right.
And so it's like, well played.
Exactly.
We'll play.
And geeks love a cameo. They love a little in reference. That's why we go hunting for them.
Well, it's like the end of Avengers, which up until Winter Soldier was my favorite comic book movie. But the way people lost it with the Thanos reveal.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it wasn't like a subtle, like, you know, it was like people losing bladder control, excitement.
Conversely, when Dark Knight Rises came out, the two moments in the movie theater where people applauded were the fantastic point where Bruce disappears on Gordon. You just go, oh, that's what that feels like.
Oh, beautiful Dark Knight.
And just the kind of extended, almost to the breaking point punchline where you get to the closing montage and Blake turns up at the reading of the will. And just the offhand, you have a lovely name. Should use it more often, Robin. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we saw it at like 11 a.m. of five people in the cinema, and there's one we all went, yes!
Exactly. That sort of call out, I mean, that's just geek pride.
It's what we live for.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, I love you. Grown men hugging each other and crying, you know, I love you. You know?
Look, likewise, more recently, I mean, the entire end sequence of Days of Future Past is incredibly sweet and is simultaneously a kind of beautiful reset and I think definitive sign-off for the original X-Men movie cast.
It does feel like a swan song, yeah.
And the moment where I just went, oh, right in the feels, was getting Kelsey Grammer
as the
adult version of Beast.
Yes.
And just the fact that they have him for 2 seconds walking down the corridor going, sleep late, Logan.
When I saw that, I was like, that sounded a lot like Kelsey Grammer.
We sat there through the credits just waiting. It was so nice, yes.
That was awesome. I also really appreciated, you know, not having Scott have died of Punk's death. And
Lord, yes.
I mean, didn't he refuse to do that scene in Last Stand?
Marsden took a very long time to not quite deny that he had refused to be involved with that movie. And he did it in a way that was very classy. He did make it clear that he had real issues with how the character was dealt with and how the character was written out. So, yeah, and it was really, really nice to have him and Famke Janssen as Jean back. And that closed the circle on Logan wonderfully, too. I love how in those last couple of minutes you have this guy who remembers everything. From the timeline that's been erased, from the future that's been erased, and at the same time is going, this is the best possible outcome. And he doesn't quite know how to deal with being at peace. And that was really beautifully dealt with, I thought.
And also, Jesse, part of me would be upset if he doesn't have the enantium throughout him at this timeline. That would bother me.
I would guess that he does.
Yeah.
I think, again, to kind of fold in Doctor Who terminology, I would guess that Logan undergoing the Weapon X treatment is a fixed point in time. Mm-hmm. It's something that can be delayed, but it's something that has to have taken place.
Well, especially with the post-credit sting where we see Mystique having taken the place of Stryker.
Well, that doesn't mean Stryker's dead, but that's
of course not.
Yeah.
that means that she might be getting him to safety, but he still could end up with, still end up there. Because there's only so much things that will happen. Now, Magneto, Grant, we're now crossing into X-Men.
Of course.
Yeah.
So one of the things, I love the young Magneto, but it's very complicated in watching him going from he's making sense to not making sense. So the entire realizing I'm going to have to kill Mystique because she's going to like screw things up for us, I get. Don't agree with. I agree with Professor X logic of I can convince her. But then going, I'm going to pick up RFK Stadium and override the Sentinels and execute the President of the United States and the majority of the cabinet seems like a bad plan and also a weird turn because he was making sense for a while.
There was a beautiful turn of phrase for how that particular plot line played out, where several reviewers said you have this really nice moment where you have the older Magneto, who's obviously carrying the weight of guilt of a lot of the things he's done in his life, like, you'll need both of us. And then they break the younger Magneto out, and instantly he seems to go, I will now spend the rest of the movie proving to you that was the worst possible thing you could have done.
Uh-huh.
And it's not so much that it's a weakness, but it is, as you say, it's a drastic kind of character gear shift that is almost, it's very nearly the one beat the movie fumbles a little bit.
Well, there's no, I just can't find a purpose for Magneto's freedom for the second half of the movie.
Because they're working well together. It doesn't make, after the plane flight and them, talking and playing chess and being willing to kill Mystique for peace, it doesn't make sense for him to go,
well, now I'm going to attack Cabinet.
Yeah, I'm going to assassinate the president. I'm going to drop RFK Stadium around the White House. I'm going to do all of these things. And it's not even a military coup. It's to set an example by decapitating a good chunk of the U.S. government.
The one potential justification I could see for it is because, it's a long plane ride, so presumably Logan opens up a good deal about when he's from. Because it is such a horrifying future, and one that so very clearly echoes Eric Lynch's childhood, there, I can see a very skewed, very warped line of thinking of the best possible way for me to prevent this is one of two things. I either do kind of chronological needlework and remove the woman who will kill the man who will create the situation, or we go public and I have this enforced, almost terror-based singularity where I definitively say, we are here. If you mess with us, we will kill you.
It's not like a preemptive first strike.
It's absolutely a preemptive first strike. And I find it very interesting that you get this situation, which is almost the worst possible one it can be, and that the character who is instrumental in turning it around is Mystique.
Because she's the one who saves the president and saves a bunch of folks and makes Magneto look like the villain.
Precisely.
And simultaneously discrediting the Sentinel program, which if Magneto was just going to discredit the Sentinel program, like have them shoot each other and, have it be a bad weapon, that'd be one thing to do the discredit. But you shouldn't kill the president. I'm going to go with probably, I did some research, that should have been in January of 73.
Mm-hmm.
So Nixon should have just been sworn in for the second term. Spiro Agnew would still be vice president because he hasn't resigned yet.
Right.
Because that's not for a few more months. And D.C. in January is cold and miserable, and it looks like summer. So, I have a little issue there. But he probably would have killed the president. I don't think the VP would have been on hand for it.
No, because they divide them when there's a panic situation.
Yeah, but this isn't a panic situation. Like for doing the product demo, but you don't necessarily break out everybody. So there probably would have been the president, possibly the Secretary of State, most definitely the Secretary of Defense, likely the Attorney General, possibly the Speaker of the House, And so you would, people who were in line to be president. So the patchwork, if he had succeeded on who would have been the 38th president, would have been kind of convoluted depending on who's left standing. Because if Agnew was there and the speaker were there, it'd go to the president pro tempore of the Senate, who was like, okay, that could be one outcome. But if you knock out a bunch of congressional people who can then go to the Secretary of State, who may or may not have been there and been alive. So, like, it gets very complicated. So Magneto would not decapitate the United States government. He might kill the first seven people in line, but then the United States would have a new president, somebody that probably most folks had not heard of. And then it would have been all-out war on the mutants for what he did. And so it was really not a smart play by Magneto.
Exactly. My point is I just don't see his motivation in what he was trying to accomplish. If he was just trying to raise the profile of the mutants by forcing a confrontation to reveal their identity, there are a lot of other ways it could have been done.
Yeah, and I totally get sabotaging the Sentinels.
Mm-hmm.
That totally makes sense to have them. Let's have them malfunction and shoot each other. Let's humiliate this dude and make him look like a really bad idea.
Right. But that should have been enough by itself.
So.
But then we didn't get the fantastic visual effects. So,
this is true.
It's the Hollywood conceit there, I think.
Yeah, there is that. And don't get me wrong, I loved the movie. I'm a strong believer that the first X-Men movie resurrected the comic book genre movie.
Oh, it did. It also, there's a strong case for saying it also resurrected Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
I was a comic store retailer in very late 90s through to about 2005. And from a financial point of view, it was an open secret that Marvel were 20 seconds from bankrupt for 5 to 6 years in that time period. It's the reason why Sony have Spider-Man and Fantastic Four. It's the reason why Fox have the X-Men, because those trademarks were sold off, and they were sold off at a substantially lower cost than they should have been. Now, the interesting thing that's starting to come around now, and one of the perils of doing the work I do, is an awful lot of the time, three quarters of what you're dealing with is rumor. One quarter of it is fact. There is a persistent rumor that in the next year, the Fantastic Four titles will be pulled because
it's been shut down.
Yeah, I saw that this morning.
Because the thinking apparently is essentially it's Marvel paying, working and paying out to promote a Fox movie that will have no financial return on their part. Now, I'm not sure I believe that. I think there may well be a grain of truth to it, but I'm not sure I believe it. But I absolutely agree with you. You don't get the last 15 years of superhero cinema. And the fact that superhero cinema has transitioned from this very mid-budget, 25 people all go see it thing, to Winter Soldier is a huge event movie. I do not know anyone with internet access who is not pounding on the door wanting to see Guardians of the Galaxy now. All the attention that's being paid, rightly or wrongly, to Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, all that stuff. You don't get that without that first Bryan Singer directed X-Men movie.
Yep. Which they did okay in the sequel and then destroyed
in X3.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen all the Wolverine movies because I didn't feel the desire to.
The Wolverine does some really, the second one does some really interesting things. I believe it's the Hiroshima bombing as an unusual dramatic inciting incident, in that it's not the traditional dramatic crutch that is often used, but rather provides very justifiable character motivation for several people, including the villain. It's extremely well shot. It's extremely well acted. There is a mid-credit stinger that sets up Days of Future Past, but at the same time, Days of Future Past completely overwrites, which is very unusual. But it's the second Wolverine movie is worth your time. The first, unless, like me, you have a pathological love of the 5 minutes of Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, not so much.
I've seen parts of it on cable. Actually, I think I've seen all of it. But yeah, it just, I didn't feel the magic.
No.
And that's important. I see the previews for Guardians of the Galaxy, which I initially was concerned, like, this could be the stupidest thing that Marvel's done, and then watch it, and I'm cheering.
Yes. I have a playlist now on my iPad that is just that song. Yeah. I mean, you listen to that song, and you're just in the mood for a raccoon with a machine gun.
It's just, this could be brilliant. This could be brilliant. And so I'm super stoked on that level. I read a lot of the science fiction space comics as a kid. You know, at the time I was growing up, my favorite comic book character, one of them was Captain Marvel, the original pre-Captain Marvel. And, you know, reading the Death of Captain Marvel graphic novel was amazing. I got comics from the 70s with him, running around with Rick Jones, everyone's favorite sidekick for at least once, when they had to share the mega band, and also Adam Warlock. You know, so there were great space stories. And the Guardians of the Galaxy that I remember were very, very different. Different characters entirely, different lineup. So this will be interesting. I'm hoping it's a way to work in the current Captain Marvel.
We all are.
Which they could do simply because Earth's been visited by the Kree, that we learned in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Right. Of course.
And the fact that Star-Lord got kidnapped as a kid, that's in the 80s. This is how he's in space in 2014. You could have a very quick backstory type thing that there was the Kree Captain Marvel, that he died, that Carol and he had a relationship, and that she now carries the mantle. They could do that and have it work.
There was a news story that surfaced about 8 months ago, and it never went anywhere. And in my experience, that means one of two things.
It's true.
Exactly, that there is nothing to it, or it's true. And it was an interview with Katie Sackhoff, and she was asked about working with Marvel, and she said, all I can tell you is they've asked me if I'm free in 2014. And
I have all my fingers and toes.
She would be great.
She'd be absolutely amazing. And if you look at the current issues of the comics, the image is starting to... Yes, exactly. Just the way Tony started to skew with Downey Jr.
Because he looks so much like him, as you say. But I'm...
Which makes me even more excited because Carol and Jen
could fit well
are the
together.
Best of friends in the comics. Oh,
and also, the other way that you can conceivably bring Captain Marvel, the Carol Danvers version in, is, of course, we're getting the Jessica Jones series through Netflix very shortly. And again, Carol is Jessica's buddy.
Exactly. You know?
So you're starting to see, I mean, and this is where my training comes in. I mean, my degrees are in English and English literature, and specifically postmodernism. And I am perpetually fascinated by the architecture of fiction. And Marvel are either doing the best impression possible of preparing to bring in characters like Captain Marvel and setting up a Black Widow solo movie with her fantastic arc through Winter Soldier, or they are setting up a Captain Marvel movie because they're putting the structures in place for it and setting up a Widow movie further down the line.
Good.
I think they
I'm
will.
Sorry, DC. You can't tell me there's no ability to do a Wonder Woman movie.
I'm pretty sure Marvel's going to beat DC to the punch with the solo female movie.
Good.
Yes.
They're doing things right. And I look at producers in DC and just wonder, what are the discussions like? Do you think... Only 54% of the population is women. There just isn't a market looking at all the fangirls out there of doing a superhero movie for a woman.
And
it doesn't make sense.
And Marvel puts a raccoon with a machine gun
in
and
front
we're
of
all ready to throw them our money.
Yes, which I'm cool with. And, but, you know, you think back to Alien and Aliens, you know, that you have the Sigourney Weaver effect, that you have Gravity.
Linda Hamilton.
Yeah, and so there are plenty of women actors who have just kicked ass in a story. It's not like some Lifetime Channel woman story. It's a superhero story.
Right.
It's a science fiction story that rocks because it's a good story.
Exactly. And I mean, the thing which DC seem to be tremendously guilty of is they are very good at being gun-shy at the last possible minute. Uh-huh. And it was an open secret that 2-3 years ago, they were, in fact, as Smallville was winding down, and I had a huge amount of time for Smallville. It was one of those shows that was successful despite you expecting it not to be. And some of the stuff they did in the back 5 years in particular, especially as the Iron Man movies were taking off, and their version of Ollie, who was so very clearly a Tony Stark riff, really worked very, very well. And there was an initial attempt to transition from Smallville into a Blue Beetle show, which got as far as, I believe, a pilot script, and is still in development 5 years later. There were several movies announced as being in development that have gone away, one of which was Supermax, which was going to be a supervillain prison film.
Wow.
And was going to introduce Green Arrow. And Ollie was it would open with Ollie being framed for a crime he didn't commit, being sentenced to a Supermax prison. You would find out who he was in retrospect as he broke out, proved his innocence, and had to deal with all these people. And Amazon. And Amazon was going to be you would use the Smallville model of it being a high school show, and it was going to be the Wonder Woman show. It was cast. It was written. They had a fantastic Scottish actress who was far and away the best thing about the British version of being human, locked in to play Diana. And at the last minute, they went with this nonsensical David E. Kelly pilot script, which throws Adrian Palicki under the bus, is unwatchably awful, and manages to pull together in Palicki and Tracy Toms two of the best character actresses of their generations, and give them nothing to do.
Yeah, well, David E. Kelly has molested the practice of law. And I say to thee, no more. No more. I need to draw a line. It's, you know, I can't watch lawyer TV shows because of David E. Kelly. You know, I want to throw things at the TV screen because he made every woman attorney look like some bimbo who just wanted to find a dude and have a kid. And it's just like, wow, thank you for spitting on the profession. It's just not okay. Because I take our profession seriously.
Of course.
But, yeah, it's insane the disappointment that we've seen with some of these things. But I take hope because there are good things afoot. Mm-hmm. And Marvel seems to have things keyed in. The Flash looks good.
Yes, very good.
So I think if they can get... They've made Arrow work, you know. I want to hear him called Green Arrow. And the setup for the Flash has been good, so they can just like jump in and go, because they basically took out the backstory. You don't need the origin story now because it happened in Green Arrow. Just start. Right. And the fact with like you had Reverse Flash in there killing his mom, it's just like, good. The foundation's there. Run with it.
One of the things that was confirmed with that a couple of weeks ago as well, and I'm delighted by this, because this was a piece of casting I was really holding out for. John Wesley Shipp has been cast as Barry's dad.
Which is awesome.
So you have the original kind of late 90s TV Flash showing up, and I'm delighted by that.
Good. It's very sweet. And I watched the original Flash.
Me too.
I liked it a lot. And it's like, cool, this is a good thing. And I'm excited when Netflix puts to sea with four Marvel titles.
Yeah.
Because people are going to binge watch those over a weekend.
Yes.
I mean,
and by people.
With Twitter parties.
Yeah. It will make my day. And again, we are available for cameos. So if you want to have Matt Murdock going up against somebody in motion practice.
We'll be the paralegals in the background. That's great.
I can recommend a judge who'd be happy to play.
Yes.
And I'm happy to tag in. So that would be awesome. So. But yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been, I mean, I appreciate interacting with you both over Twitter, knowing that you're, you know, 6,000 miles away, you know, on an island nation. So that's pretty cool. And it's nice to actually meet you in person and have this experience to talk about, not just She-Hulk, but we crossed into X-Men and Fantastic Four and a few other things. This has been very, very groovy.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Oh, my pleasure. And this will go live soon. And until then, America and the United Kingdom, stay geeky. Stay geeky.